Imagine a man who has an annoying cough that just won't go away. And when I say annoying, I mean like it's annoying enough or bad enough that at night it wakes him up, it wakes his wife up. It's annoying enough that if you were having a conversation with him, if he talks for too long, he will start coughing in the middle of the conversation. And so this man goes to his local pharmacist, and he, you know, goes to CVS or Walgreens or wherever he happens to go, and he tries every single over-the-counter cough medicine, cough suppressant that he can find, and he just can't seem to get any relief from it. Nothing seems to work. So he goes to his doctor, and he says, "I have this annoying cough, and I just can't get rid of it." And so the doctor runs some tests, and the doctor finds out that the man has lung cancer. Now, imagine the doctor knows how tough this news would be for the man to handle. So he doesn't tell him. Instead, he writes a prescription for some really powerful prescription cough medicine. So the man takes him, and the man's like, "This is so great. Thank you. I finally get what I need." And so the man is relieved. He goes to his local pharmacy. He gets the prescription filled. He goes home. He reads the directions, and it says, "Take this, and within 24 hours, you'll begin to feel better." And so he takes his first dose, and lo and behold, 24 hours later, his cough has subsided. He's able to sleep. He's able to have a conversation. He's rested. The cough medicine seems to have solved his problem. Meanwhile, very quietly, the cancer is slowly eating away at his body. As a pastor, each and every week, I talk to people who are hurting, stressing, cheating, lusting, spending, worrying, medicating, avoiding, searching. And they are always looking for a way to fix their cough. But what if there was something far more destructive lurking silently within each and every one of us, slowly destroying us from the inside? Today we begin a new series titled "The Award Goes To." And our key verse for this series is going to be found in the small New Testament letter written by a guy by the name of John. And if you've never read John's letter before, it's a short letter that is packed with only five chapters, but it's full of interesting information, and it's got this, like, inherently, the way John writes it to his readers, there's this inherent tension that occurs in this letter. And this tension occurs over and over and over again. And the tension is, on one hand, you have John telling his readers, telling the people, the hearers, he's telling them, hey, do not love the world. Don't love the world. Don't love the things of this world. Don't love the stuff of this world. And on the other hand, the tension is John saying, but love this world. Love the people in this world. Love the people in this world. And so he's saying, don't love the things of this world, but love the people of this world. And you get this sense that John, maybe he knew something that we also feel at times, that when we as human beings are left to our own, we tend to get this backwards. As human beings, we tend to fall deeply in love with the things of this world at the expense and neglect of the people in this world. And so John balances this tension back and forth for five chapters, and then he gets to the very last line, the very end of his book, and he writes sort of to sum it all up, to kind of say, now that I've said all of this about loving the world and not loving the world, but loving people of the world, he says, now that I've said all this, let me just give you this advice. And in 1 John chapter 5, verse 21, he says this: "Dear children, keep yourselves from what?" Keep yourselves from? Let's try this again at all of our campuses. He says, "Dear children, keep yourselves from
idols.
Now, maybe you are here today, and I don't know where you are on your spiritual journey across all of our campuses. Maybe you're here today, and when you see that word idols, you immediately are like, idols? Oh, I got it. All right. Check. I'm good. Because in your mind, right, and I think for many of us in our mind, when we hear the word idols, what we think of is maybe an image like this, which is an ancient Mesopotamian idol. We think of these little statues, these maybe bronze, maybe ceramic, maybe stone, maybe metal, maybe gold, whatever. And it's these little statues that people we read in ancient religions would go and they would worship at. And maybe that's what our mind first goes to. And while we still live in a world, I would say, where billions of people on a daily basis do worship different idols in one form or another, I think the majority of us, when it comes to this, would say, I'm good. I'm good. But are we? Are we good? Or are our idols just harder to diagnose? You see, several thousand years ago in the Old Testament, there was a prophet named Ezekiel. And when he was talking about the human heart and the human condition, he said that you and I as human beings have set up idols in our hearts. In fact, John Calvin, who was one of the reformers, he wrote it this way. He said that for you and I, our hearts are a factory of idols. That you and I as human beings, part of who we are, part of our nature, is we may not make physical idols, but our heart, the idols that we worship, the things that we value are deeply embedded within our soul. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who's a pastor in London, he gives a really helpful definition, and he says it this way, and I love what he says. He says, an idol is anything in my life that occupies a place that should be occupied by God alone. An idol is something that holds such a controlling position in my life that it moves and rouses and attracts me so easily that I am willing to give my time, attention, and money to it effortlessly. You see, I think for you and I, the idols that we have are far worse than tiny little statues that go on our mantle or in our homes. Our idols are the loves, the thoughts, the desires, the longings, and the expectations in life that we worship and place in a position of salvific preference. We think that there are things, longings, expectations, desires, thoughts, loves, that if only we could achieve them, if only we could get them, our life would be so much better. Maybe the simplest way to put it as an idol is whatever or whoever you and I give central value in our hearts. And what happens is, you see, as we elevate things in our hearts and give it preeminence and give it priority and we give it stature that maybe it shouldn't have, as we give it this place of value, what happens is our life becomes determined and directed by the things we value. And so what ends up happening is the very things that we are looking to for value become the things that guide and direct our very hearts and our very lives. They control us. And so maybe a question this morning as we begin this series is one for you to begin wrestling with. What or who controls your heart? And I'm not saying this just to people who don't believe in Jesus. I'm saying this to myself and to all of us. What or who controls your heart? Now, you could hear this and you could say, okay, like, sure, I'll play along, Adam. We'll see where this goes over the next couple weeks. I'll play along. Maybe work controls my heart. Work is my idol, if you want to call it that, Adam. When I'm at work, I'm fully invested, I'm dived in, I'm dialed in, I'm focused, and when I go home, the way I treat my kids, the way I treat my roommate, the way I treat my spouse, my behavior, my actions are all dependent on the mood I'm in because of how work went. Work is able to control my mood with my families. When I get home, and if it's a stressful day, I'm stressed at them. If it was a calming day, I'm calm with them. But then even then, when I'm home, I get a little anxious because work does control me, where even though I'm home for a couple hours, I still have to make sure the laptop's open, or I still pull up email every now and then. I still have the notifications, so just in case work needs something. And then when I finally get the kids to bed and I spend a little time with the spouse, then I go into the office, into the study, and I look at what I have next for the next day because I want to make sure that when I get to work the next day, everything is as it needs to be because I don't want to get in there and fail because work controls a little bit of my heart. I put a lot of time and energy into it to make sure everything works out okay. Let me just push a little deeper for a second. And over the next couple weeks, I'm going to do my best to kind of take us pretty deep. This series will be a little more theological than maybe some of our other ones, and I hope you'll see that it'll be a little more maybe even transparent than some of our other ones, because I'm going to open up and even share some areas of my life as we deal with these different idols. And perhaps as we talk about idols, it's best to think of the image of a tree. When you look at a tree, typically, maybe you're different, but the first thing most people see, depending on the season, is the branches, the leaves, the blooms, or the fruit. If it's winter and there's no leaves, we immediately notice the tall trunk and the branches that are going out. If it's spring, we notice all of a sudden the blooms that are coming. If it's summer, we notice the leaves. If it's late or early fall, we notice the fruit that's hanging down ready to be picked. If it's late fall, we notice the color that's changing among the leaves. Our mind instinctively goes to the branches and the leaves and the blooms and the fruits. And I think for many of us, not all of us, but for many of us, when we talk about these idols in our lives, we focus so much on the branches, the visible things that we can see. And we might say that if we are being transparent and honest, that we probably put too much central value in things like our career or money or sex or our spouse or our kids or whatever it happens to be. And we typically focus on these fruit that hang out there and say, that's the thing that has priority and value in my life. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but when it comes to trees, the top is actually not the biggest part. In fact, if you asked most arborists, they would say that however wide the diameter of the branches are, the roots are usually 2 to 5 times wider underneath the soil. Why is this important? Because almost every single fruit that you see in your life that feels like an idol is not the point. The point is the deeper root system that's feeding it. And so many times in our spiritual life, we think we can just have these moments where we begin trimming off branches and picking fruit, and hopefully our life will be better and we'll be more focused on Jesus, but we never get deep into the issue of the root cause of what is making those flowers bloom in the first place. It's as if the branches are the cough and the roots are the cancer that is growing wild underneath. And so over the next couple of weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to look at several of these root idols that feed the branches and the fruit and how it manifests in our lives. And what I hope you see through this series is no sense of guilt or shame or condemnation. What I hope you see is that so many times when I talk to people, they feel like they are cutting branches or trimming fruit only to come back to the same thing months or years or weeks later over and over and over again. And I just want to say it's because you never found the root of the issue. And my prayer and my hope is that as we go through this series, many of you will find the peace and the freedom from comes to dealing with the root idols in your life. And so this morning, we're going to start with what I think is the easiest one, the root idol of comfort. The root idol of comfort. Now, I'm sure some of you know this, but comfort seems to creep into our lives so easily in American culture. We live in a culture where the American dream is a thing. And maybe hundreds of years ago when our country was founded, the American dream probably meant something much differently than it does right now. The American dream in its original conception was this idea that maybe you were a blacksmith living in England and you could come to America, to the colonies, to a place where you would be free, and you could come here, and just because your father was a blacksmith and your grandfather was a blacksmith doesn't mean that you needed to be a blacksmith and your children and your grandchildren needed to be a blacksmith. No, you could come to America and you could make a name for yourself. You could be anything that you wanted to be through hard work and education and the right luck and skill in certain moments. You could have the dream of being whatever you wanted to be. But somewhere along the way, and this is my opinion, but somewhere along the way, I think the American dream shifted from that to this thing of the American dream is you can have a nice house and a nice car and a good job and kids. And you can work hard, and you can have vacations, and then your kids can go to college or join the military, and they can serve, and they can have a better life than you did. And then one day you can retire and relax. It's as if the American dream at some point became this thing of saying, listen, the American dream is you can live a life of comfort. You can live a life of ease. You can live a life that's relaxing and full of pleasure, and you can really dream about what you want to be doing with your life, and you can find that is something you can do here that you can't do in any other third world country. No one retires in third world countries. The American dream is that you can be comfortable and relax and find pleasure in things. And so if we're honest, we seek it out. We seek out pleasure. We seek out comfort. Why? Because the world tells us that comfort equals the good life. And this can come in many different forms, and maybe you have your own form you're already thinking of. For some of us, the comfortable life means sitting down in your living room after a long day at work and simply enjoying a show on Netflix. That's comfortable. For some of us, the comfortable life is making sure we have enough margin in our financial life that we can have several vacations a year because we didn't get that with our parents. For some of us, the comfortable life is making sure that our kids are on the right travel ball team so that they can make it to all the tournaments and get seen by a scout and get into the right college and hopefully just one day the American dream that they will become a professional sports athlete. For some of us, we can find comfort in a relationship. We don't want to be alone, and so the idea of being with somebody else brings us comfort and security, and it brings us pleasure, and so we want to be with other people. For some of us, the idea of comfort is being alone. We want no one else telling us what to do. We want to be our own boss in our own life, in our own way, in charge of our own destiny, independence, and autonomous. So we do our things our way. And the list could go on and on and on. Maybe for some of us, comfort is the idea if we get enough stuff, we'll be comfortable. If we can do the things we want in life, we'll be comfortable. If we can have what we've always wanted. And here's the interesting part. I think what makes this idol so dangerous in our lives is that comfort, deep in our core, when it comes to comfort, it's something we think we deserve. And maybe I'm just being a little open here. Maybe that's just me. I know there are moments in my life, seasons in my life, there are days and weeks in my life where I come home and I'm like, you know what? It has been a long day at work. I just want to go in my basement and I just want to turn on a movie and surround sound and watch the movie and I don't want anyone to bother me. Why? Because I worked hard. I had to go to the hospital. I had to take care of this. I had to plan for this wedding. I had to get ready for this sermon. I had to lead a staff. I worked hard and I'm tired and I just deserve a little relaxation. And don't we all feel that on some level or another? Like we feel like we're entitled to a moment of pleasure. We're entitled to relax. We're entitled to have these moments or these seasons or these episodes in our lives where we do something that is comfortable for us because we earned it. We deserved it. We worked hard. We put in the time. We served other people, whatever it happens to be. But we feel like it's something we need. And so what happens is we begin to structure our life around it, creating opportunities for us to be comfortable and to find pleasure and to relax. And when someone or something keeps us from our pleasure and our comfort, we may even respond in frustration and anger. Those of you that are parents, you will understand this. I can remember seasons in my life when my kids were younger, and I would come home from a busy day at work, full of all kinds of appointments and counseling and studying and everything else. And I would come home just exhausted. And you know, you still come home and you sit in the driveway for a minute and you're like, all right, it's game time, let's do this. And you go inside and you have two young boys who are crazy, like little terrorists running around the house. And you go inside and you hang out with them and you do dinner and then you do bedtime. And then you finally get them to sleep and you go downstairs and you sit on the couch and you turn on the TV and you're just, oh, and you have a moment to relax. And you turn on a show, and 12 minutes in, there's a child behind the couch. Dad, I can't sleep. And in that moment, you just sigh. Why? Because you earned that comfort. You earned that moment. And now they're going to ruin it? That's not fair. That doesn't feel right. Maybe for you, maybe it's more of a, maybe you're an overseer or a boss and you have employees who work for you. Or maybe you just have a really busy job. And it's one of those days where you've been going from thing to thing to thing, putting out fire after fire, one thing after another, meeting to meeting, and you finally get a chance in your office. You don't even have time to go out to lunch, so you finally grab the lunch you brought with you, and you get a chance to sit down at your cubicle or sit in your office, and you realize you have 30 minutes till your next appointment, and you just want a moment to eat this meal, and as you take your third bite, there's a knock on the door. Hey, boss, I know you're trying to eat, but this is urgent. And you just sigh. What is it? Because you earned that moment. You deserve a little comfort. Now, hear me clearly because I don't want anyone leaving here thinking I said otherwise. Comfort is not a bad thing. Seeking comfort is not a bad thing. Wanting comfort is not a bad thing. Having comfortable things in life is not a bad thing. Please hear me very clearly. Comfort is not a bad thing. In fact, I would even argue theologically, it is not a bad thing because honestly, comfort is what your soul wants. What do I mean by that? Some of you are familiar with the story, but if you go back to the very beginning of the Bible, all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, you see that God, and a loving God and gracious God, he created the most perfect earth that there ever be. He created this place called the Garden of Eden, and he made two human beings in this garden. And when you read the account of what happened in that garden, you have this sense that it was this place that was full of pleasure and comfort and relaxation. Adam and Eve were walking around naked and felt no shame. They felt no guilt. They felt no remorse. Their emotional life was free of any burden. They didn't have to work. They didn't have jobs. They didn't have the stress of dealing with emotions of any kind that were negative. It was a life of perfect pleasure and comfort and ease and relaxation. And then in Genesis chapter 3, because they decided to step outside of the protective boundary that God had made for them, we're told that sin entered the world. And if you read that account in Genesis chapter 3, what you see is the way it speaks of this thing called the fall when sin enters. It uses language of pain and discomfort. We see things like childbearing, which is definitely not comfortable. We see things like desires and emotions that go unfilled. Things are not what they should be. We see pain and sweat and dissatisfaction from work. In essence, what we see is this thing that was perfect and full of pleasure and rest and comfort becomes an environment full of discomfort. It's lacking what it intentionally was made to have in the beginning. And I would argue that on some level or another, every single human being since that day in Genesis chapter 3, our hearts, our soul has longed, has wanted, has desired a return to a place of comfort and rest and pleasure and relaxation. Comfort is what our soul wants. I mean, just think about the way that Jesus talks about comfort. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 4, he says this. He says, blessed are those who mourn, for they were what? They will be comforted. In other words, that you can have a lot of hurt and a lot of pain in life. And Jesus says, listen, it is okay to have comfort. It is okay to be comforted. It is okay to want your soul to feel a little different. It is okay that even in the midst of struggles with the burdens you carry, there is something right about seeking comfort. It's human and it's honest and it's real. In 2 Corinthians 1, 3 through 4, Paul, when he's describing God, he says this. He says, praise be to God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, because he is the Father of compassion and the God of all what? Comfort. And he says, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we receive ourselves from God. In other words, comfort, 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 comfort. In other words, God is a God of comfort. God is a God who comes to his people in the midst of their uneasiness, in the midst of their chaotic lives, and he brings comfort and peace and restoration. No wonder our soul wants comfort. No wonder it's something that we long for. On this side of the garden, we know life is not the way it was intended to be. It's full of discomfort, and it's not supposed to be that way. And so we long for it. We see this. One of my favorite examples is in the Old Testament book of Exodus and Numbers. We see in Exodus where God's people are in Israel, or they're in Egypt in slavery. And I'm not going to read the account, but just know that their slavery in Egypt, it was brutal and it was difficult and it was hard. And they had taskmasters and slave drivers who made their life miserable and uncomfortable. And there was no pleasures and no relaxation. And then God, through miracles, using Moses as his hand and his feet, he freed them from the Egyptians. And they marched across the Red Sea and the water comes back in. And they find themselves in this desert. And as they're wandering through the desert, their only focus in this moment is to depend on God to guide them and lead them. And every single day, God is providing food that they need just for that day, providing exactly everything that their heart, their soul, and their physical well-being should need. And we see in Numbers chapter 11, verse 4 and 6, even in the midst of this, what do? They complain. Take a look. It says, the rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. At no cost, like you were slaves. We remember what we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also, man, there were cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. All things that had flavor, things that brought pleasure besides this bland and plain manna. Oh, man, but now we have lost our appetites because we never see anything but this manna. In other words, the Israelite people are saying, listen, if only we could go back to what was comfortable. But even the thing they wanted to go back to was failed and broken. Our hearts, who we are, long for comfort. Here's the problem. Comfort is what our soul wants, but rest is what your soul needs. Comfort is what you feel like you want, but rest is what you need. And those of you that are parents, you understand this. There is a difference between what a child wants and what a child needs. I have two boys. They want to play video games and eat ice cream and cookies all day. But they don't need that. There are things in my life that I want, but I trust that God knows that I don't need them. There's a difference. Rest is what your soul needs. There's a professor at Portland State University School of Psychology, and he did an experiment on this idea of comfort versus discomfort. And what he did was he took Google and he went to the Google image searches and he began typing in words. And the first word he typed in was the word discomfort. And he paid attention to the images that came up to describe discomfort. And he noticed things like this, like the image that came up of people doubled over in pain. People who were having stomach aches. And people who were grasping their temples as if something was wrong. So then he took the same Google search and he typed the word comfort into the Google image search. And this time the images that came back to him were images of leather couches. Images of nice comfy pajamas. And images of yummy comfort food. And some of you just got hungry. And here's the observation he made. Don't miss this. He said discomfort seems to always be internal and subjectively experienced differently for every person. In other words, each person determines what makes them discomfort. But he said, but the remedies, all the ways that we seem to fix discomfort and find comfort in our culture are all external. In other words, get a more comfortable couch. Have some more comfort food. Buy this product. Enjoy this experience. And in other words, he says at the end, in other words, we're told subconsciously, without us even being aware of it, that the internal problem of discomfort is solved by external remedies. Now, can I just say, and maybe you need to write this down, an internal problem is never solved by external remedies. An internal problem is never solved by external remedies. And let me give you an example of this, of the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus is teaching in Luke chapter 12, and he's telling this story about a rich young man, and the concept applies here, and he says, verse 16, he says, then he told them a story. A rich young man had a fertile farm that produced all sorts of fine crops. Verse 17, he said to himself, what should I do? Like, in other words, I'm so successful, what should I do? I don't have any more room for all of my stuff. So he said, verse 18, then he said, I know, I'll tear down my barns, and I'm going to build bigger ones. And then when I build these bigger ones, I tear down the ones I have and build bigger ones, then I'll have enough room to store all of my wheat and all of my goods. And watch what he's going to do in verse 19. When he finally gets to this place, he says, and then I'll sit back and I'll say to myself, my friend, some translations say, my soul, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry. In other words, let me unpack this. Here's a guy who had all kinds of external things. And he's like, something feels off. Something feels missing. Something doesn't feel right. I have all this stuff, but something still doesn't feel right. So what does he try to do? He tries to convince his soul. He tries to convince himself. He's like, soul, what's wrong with you? You have everything you need. Look how comfortable. Look how plush. Look how relaxing. Look how this. You have everything you could ever want. Why is something not right? Because for you and I, the moment that we feel internally that something isn't right in our life, the moment our soul feels uneasy, the moment we feel we are not at rest, what happens is we try to convince ourselves, and we laugh at this and say, why would he ever think he can convince ourselves? And we do this when we feel worried, when we feel stressed, when we feel uncomfortable. We always turn to something external to solve the problem. Verse 20 continues, but God said to him, you fool. You will die this very night, then who will get everything that you worked for? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth but not have a rich relationship with God. In other words, you will never find soul-level satisfaction with temporary earthly comforts. I want to say that again in case you missed it. You will never find soul-level satisfaction with temporary earthly comforts. And I can't emphasize this enough. The danger that we live in is that you and I can have all the things in the world. We can have a good life, a good social status. We can have a nice house, a nice car, a nice job, nice vacations. And I'm not talking about material things. We can have all sorts of biblical knowledge and all sorts of religious activity and be doing all of these things. We can be good, decent, moral, upstanding people. We can have all of these things, all of these creature comforts, and still have a soul that does not have rest. It's as if most of the things that we chase in life that we think will find us comfort are just treating a cough and avoiding the cancer. Why? Because our soul needs rest. Our soul needs rest. And Jesus, what I love about the good news of the gospel is Jesus offers us rest in Matthew 11, 28 and 29. He says this. He says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and it is through me that you will find rest in your souls. We need rest. But rest is found in Jesus, not the things of this world. External things will never fix what's wrong. You don't need more comfort. You need rest. Now, here's the weird tension in this. In Luke chapter 14, look what Jesus says. He says, a large crowd was following Jesus, and he turned and said to them, what does he say to them? Just listen to this. He says, if you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else. Your father, your mother, your wife, your children, your brothers, your sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. So here's the tension I want you to see, the tension of the Christian faith. And maybe you are new today and you haven't decided to follow Jesus yet. I want you to hear the tension that exists in the Christian faith is that on one hand, we have Jesus saying, listen, come to me and I will give you rest. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. And on the other hand, he says, people who follow me, they don't live comfortable lives. People who follow me, they do uncomfortable things. They do hard things. They do difficult things. Why? Because the call to follow Jesus and rest in him is the call to elevate him above everything and everyone in your life. In other words, the call to follow Jesus means wherever you externally think that thing will comfort you and fulfill the uneasiness and the unrest you have in your soul, Jesus is saying to follow me, you must love me more than that thing. For you, maybe you would say, man, the thing that brings me comfort is having a loving person in my life. Let me just tell you that Christ is better than being in love. Christ is better than having a perfect spouse. Christ is better than having healthy children. Christ is better than seeing your children grow old one day and succeed. Christ is better than making a name for yourself. Christ is better than having a solid career. He's better than a dream home. He's better than a nice car. He's better than vacations. He's better than the retirement. He is better than anything and everything that you think will bring you comfort. Why? Because comfort might be what you think you need, but what you need is rest. And he is where you find rest, and it is in him and him alone. So, here's the question to wrestle with. What do you need to set aside that you have been seeking comfort in instead of Jesus? Now, you might be like, I don't know. I need to think about it. Think about it. One of the things I was wrestling through, I'll just personally in my own life. Sometimes being a pastor is a really demanding thing. There's a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails. There's a lot of events. There's a lot of stuff. And so there are these moments in my life where I'll get a phone call or I'll hear something about someone and they'll invite me to something. They'll invite me to go help somewhere. They'll invite me to serve or go to the hospital. I just don't want to do it because I want to be relaxed and comfortable. And here's what I know. If I value the external comforts in my life more than I value serving God's people, that thing is an idol. And maybe you have the same thing. Maybe somebody asked you to serve the local church, or they asked you to serve in your community, or they asked you to go on a mission trip overseas. And you said, man, I really love to, but I only get one vacation a year and I kind of want to take it easy. Or, you know, it's on a Saturday. And I mean, I know it's not that big a deal, but it's college football season. And so I really need the time to relax. And I've been working 6 days a week right now. I can't do something in the afternoons. And so we elevate the thing that we think will bring comfort over serving and being an influence in God's kingdom. Let me just say, you cannot live your life for the glory of God and bow at the altar of comfort. You must choose. Let's pray. Jesus, we are so thankful that in Scripture you promise rest. God, we pray just in this moment that your Spirit would be our rest. Maybe you are here today across all of our campuses. And I'm not talking about following Jesus. I'm just talking about as a human being right now. And you would say, Adam, I am seeking comfort in external things, and I need to confess that. I would love to pray for you. And I know it's going to take you being bold and honest in this moment, so I'm going to trust that you will. If you would say, man, Adam, there are people and things in my life that I have elevated and made central in my pursuit of rest and relaxation and comfort and pleasure, and I have made them the thing that's going to fix and medicate my problem, and I want to confess that today and move past it, would you just write where you are, raise your hand. Hands all over the room. If your hand is raised, I want to pray for you. Father, I pray for every hand that is raised that you would do a miracle. God, that you would show us that you are so much better than any fake earthly comfort or treasure. God, we ask for your rest. As we continue praying, you can put your hands down. As we continue praying across all of our campuses, maybe you are here today, and if you were just being honest, you would say, man, my soul is uneasy. I just don't feel restful. I feel like there's always a state of turmoil and low-level anxiety and just fear of something. I just feel like I'm just not at rest. Let me just tell you. Jesus says, take my yoke. My burden is light. I will give you rest. And maybe today, the reason you are here today is because today is the day that God has ordained and orchestrated for you to cry out and surrender to him and receive the load of Jesus that is light and easy. 2,000 years ago, he came to this earth and died for you so that you could be made new and you could rest. If you're here today and you want to surrender your life to Jesus for the very first time, with our eyes closed and heads bowed, would you just be bold and raise your hand right where you are? Jesus, I need your rest. I see your hand. I see your hand. If your hand is raised, I want you to pray this prayer with me. Heavenly Father, I am a sinner. Jesus, come into my life. Make me new. Be my king. Jesus, give me rest. Rest my anxious soul. And everyone said,
Amen.